Raken replies, with an entitled firstborn heir he has perfected. Suddenly, the virtue storms in, lifts a vase of irises from a mirrored side table, and throws it against the glass wall. It shatters into pieces. A ripple of flinches moves through the assembled assistants, but I'm used to the tides of war. Breaking glass merely gets my attention. "Every unapproved secondborn, out!" the virtue bellows. Secondborns claw each other in their haste to leave. Glisten is among the wiliest, leading the way. I don't move. After the mass exodus, only an intimate number of secondborns and a slightly larger number of firstborns remain. Some I've met before, like Valdi Schelling. Others I don't even recognize, except maybe the one in the corner, staring at me.
"How could you let this happen in Virtues, in my city?"
the virtue rages at Dune. Dune remains silent, unruffled.
"And you," the virtue points at Clifton, "you should have seen this coming."
Clifton begins making his apologies and shifting the subject to the plan for upgrading security features around the city. With the massive wartime technology my team is developing, my eyes return to the firstborn in the corner. He's still watching me. This older man seems so familiar. I don't know why. My head tilts. He smiles at my "who are you" gesture. And then recognition dawns. I should say, gates of dawns. Adrenaline crashes into my bloodstream. He's Sword Commander Walther Peetz, Dune's fraternal twin brother. Here in the Halo Palace, it must be him. My eyes go to his moniker, expecting to see a silver secondborn sword. But it's gold. He's a firstborn sword. He has the same build as Dune, with the same chiseled bone structure and the same full-lipped smile. His hair is a warm chestnut color. He wears it short, military length. His nose is different from Dune's. This man's nose has been broken a few times and never repaired. He's clean-shaven. I try to see the color of his eyes, but he's too far away.
"And you," the virtue rages on, his finger jabbing at me. "How are you still alive after you fell from the top of the Sword Social Club?"
"I'm hard to kill," I reply. His eyes flare. He glances from my face to Dune's and then back.
"You're hard to kill? That's your answer?"
"Yes." A rumble of surprised laughter shakes his shoulders.
"She's hard to kill," he roars, laughing furiously and looking over everyone in the room.
Others join him tentatively. His rage-filled gaze returns to me.
"So am I. If I find that you were a part of this, I will rip your throat out."
I nod once, not looking away. Clifton intervenes.
"I brought the security footage from the social club. We can review it now."
"Show it," the virtue barks.
Clifton nods to the secondborn star behind us. The security shutters lower over the transparent wall, blotting out the sun. Soft lighting illuminates the room. The security doors close, imprisoning us inside. The virtue remains standing, but others find seats.
Grisham gets Raken's attention and indicates a chair for him.
I choose not to sit with them, drifting to the back of the room near the wall of flowing water and its tranquil pattering sound. Clifton takes a position on one side of me. Maybe he's already seen the footage, and he was present for the event, but he doesn't watch when the holographic images of the main ballroom, the gallery level, and the gods' table take shape. The noise of the party is clamorous. I tense, waiting for the mayhem. A warm hand brushes mine with a gentle stroke against my smallest finger. I glance up at Clifton's face, a mask of remorse. Impulsively, I latch onto his hand for the briefest of moments, squeeze it, and then let it go. The holographic recording flares with light. Death gods invaded the club through a rooftop terrace entrance in pairs. More than likely, they used gravitizers, which means they had extensive military training. The assassins trickle in and blend with the revelers,
taking up positions near doors, exits, security drones, and the club's private security. Hawthorne and the Death Gods entered the building in the same way. That bothers me. Although it makes strategic sense. It's how I would enter if I wanted to get in and weren't invited.
Why aren't the drones picking them up? The Virtue bellows.
Pause, Clifton orders. The footage stills. They didn't have monikers.
The drones should have alerted us to that.
We believe they used a device that reflects the moniker closest to them. At such proximity, the drones cannot discern there are multiple people. It fools them into believing the person has simply moved. From the pocket of his trousers, he holds up a black cuff bracelet with a flat, square chip embedded in it. We recovered these from the bodies of the attackers. We've never encountered this type of technology before. My engineers are pulling them apart as we speak. We should know more soon.
Do you suspect Burton?
I do, Clifton replies without reservation.
Resume,
the Virtue orders, his hands clenched into fists. My holographic image enters the social club. I can hardly watch. The burn of adrenaline, of knowing what lies ahead, sickens me. I want to reach into her world of light and warn her, tell her to save her father. But I can't. The sound transports me back to that living nightmare. Panic seizes. My vision blurs. I'm gasping. No one notices. They're all riveted by the footage. Then the carnage begins. Reaching into my sweater pocket, I take out the packet of Chets. The cellophane wrapper crinkles loudly beneath the recorded screams of a violent massacre. My shaking fingers have a difficult time tearing open the seal. Walther eases the packet from my grasp, deftly opening it and offering me a small white stamp in his palm. I don't take it all. Instead, I rip off a corner piece and put it in my mouth. Dune's brother stuffs the rest of the Chet back into the cellophane and slips them into my pocket. Slowly, my breathing eases, though everything still has a faraway perspective. My holographic image enters the gallery, sparking cheers from some of the group assembled here. The firstborns are enjoying this, as if it were some form of entertainment. I stifle a snort of derision.
"Who is that sword?" the Virtue shouts.
"Pause," Clifton orders. "That's Hawthorne Truegrave. He's a newly transitioned firstborn. You remember him. He was at the Sword Palace the night you acquired Roselle." Acquired? Have I been acquired? Is that what they're calling my internment here?
"Get him here," the Virtue barks.
"Of course," Clifton replies. "Resume." He sends a message with his moniker. Under the influence of the Chet, I analyze the goddess Roselle before me. She's possessed, eviscerating her enemies with the vengeance of a wrathful deity. Ruthlessly, she hunts them. The fusion mag is an extension of her will. With Tyburn behind her, shielding her back, she's the north, south, and east winds. The men watching shout thunderously and applaud when Roselle slices open the leg of the flying death god with her dagger. Her fall to the ballroom floor elicits gasps. More cheers roar as she targets the flying assassin and shoots him out of the air. But when she dons goggles and spews a billowing cloud of red dust into the ballroom, the firstborns jump to their feet, clapping uproariously at the wholesale slaughter of assassins, as if she's some favored competitor in the secondborn trials. I am unable to look away. I feel nothing when the war goddess tackles the bomb-wielding assassin, crashing with him through the window and out into the night sky. The grenade explodes. All the glass blows inward, shooting shards toward the surveillance cameras. The firstborns raise their arms to their faces and gasp. The holographic footage ends. Whoops of laughter seize the group. Grisham is one of the most riotous, as if he's been on a thrill ride and can't stop talking about the experience. He turns to Raken, chatting boisterously. Raken glances over his shoulder at me. His expression is grim. I look away. The Virtue calls Clifton back to the front of the room. He and Dune brief Fabian Bowie and his advisors on their preliminary findings about the massacre. I'm barely listening.
You were brave, Walther says.
I meet his eyes. They're jade-colored, not sand.
It wasn't bravery, I reply. It was rage, a sword-fated threnody.
Remind me not to upset you.
I'll do that, Walther.
His smile is one of pure pleasure. For a moment, it soothes the ache in my chest. Dune says,
I'd like to introduce firstborn Walther Peets.
He gestures in our direction.
He's a newly transitioned firstborn, a former secondborn commanding officer at the Twilight Forest Base in Swords. His brother, Ferguson Peets, was among the casualties at the club last night. He flew in this morning to assume his new position as a military consultant to the Virtue.
Please excuse me, Roselle, Walther says, turning and making his way to the front. He calls for the holographic footage to be replayed and begins to dissect the crime, pointing out all the crucial elements the Virtue hadn't noticed. As I analyze the players before me, questions take shape in my mind. I'm no longer so certain that my mother and brother perpetuated this crime. For one thing, they weren't the only ones who had strong motives. Ferguson Peets was at the social club. His death not only elevated Dune's twin brother to firstborn, but it also afforded Dune the opportunity to infiltrate the Virtue's trusted advisory panel with yet another Gates of Dawn operative. Clifton explains the device that mirrors monikers. The accusation that it may be Burton's technology certainly plays in his favor. But is it enough of a reason to make him shoot up a sword social club? Maybe not. But the plan to install Salloway security technology everywhere throughout the City of Purity, that is. A plan like that allows Clifton to control the capital, especially when the Virtue no longer trusts the Sword military. My mind reels with all the possible political motivations for last night's slaughter. The problem is that neither the Rose Gardeners nor the Gates of Dawn wants me dead. Maybe they knew I could handle myself, if given the proper motivation. Killing my father wouldn't only motivate me, it would get them both one step closer to making me the most powerful person in the world. Raken nudges Grisham. The firstborn commander rises from his seat. Approaching the Virtue, he leans down and whispers in his father's ear. The Virtue glances at me absently. He gives a dismissive wave of his hand and then turns back to the briefing. Grisham nods to Raken, who makes his way to me.
You're cleared to leave and seek medical attention, he says. I'll accompany you.
He holds my upper arm in a tight grip. I can't pull away without making a scene. I walk with him to the exit. Raken scans his moniker, opening the security doors. Together we descend the stairs and pass by the mob of assembled guards. Neither of us speaks as we wait for the air elevator. A car arrives, and the glass doors open. A single passenger steps forward. My knees weaken. Hawthorne, I say in a hushed tone. Hawthorne's eyes widen. He looks at Raken's hand on my arm, and then to his face. With an instant snarl, Hawthorne swings his fist, connecting with Raken's jaw. A lesser man would hit the ground, but Raken doesn't fold. He strikes back, thumping Hawthorne in the throat with the heel of his hand. Wheezing and reeling, Hawthorne stumbles sideways. Raken kicks him in the side. Hawthorne lurches forward and tackles Raken. They crash hard onto the marble floor. Exo-guards surround them and pull them apart. Enough! I shout. I wait for them to stop struggling against the guards. Let them go, I order the security team. They both have important business with the Virtue. Firstborn Truegrave was summoned here. But I'm secondborn and have no authority. I'm completely ignored. A female guard scans Hawthorne's and Raken's monikers. She nods to the other guards. Both men are tentatively released, but burly exos surround them. Drones circle, their weapons trained on the pair. The female guard turns to Raken.
Do you want to press charges, Firstborn Winterstrom?
Hawthorne jerks in my direction. His eyes burrow into me. He recognizes the name as the Winterstrom crest seared into my palm.
Raken, I say in my sweetest tone, can you decide on that later? I missed breakfast, and I was hoping you'd join me. I know you like ham and eggs.
Hawthorne's aggressive posture slowly eases. He understood that I meant our friends, Hammond and Edgerton.
Raken straightens his black sleeve, pulling down on the cuff.
Anything for you, Roselle.
From his pocket, he takes out a small square of cloth and dabs the blood from the corner of his mouth. He turns to the female guard.
Let him go. Truegrave has a meeting with the Virtue,
and I have an appointment for brunch.
Raken joins me by the airlift. We enter the elevator car together. I don't turn to see Hawthorne's expression as I leave. I can't bear it. He knows now that I've been hiding how I got my scar and what it means. If he doesn't already suspect that I'm a fate traitor, he will soon.
Chapter 11. The Promise of Dawn. The air elevator descends. Tears brighten my eyes. My body begins to tremble.
He won't talk, I whisper. You control the lives of the people he loves.
Shh, Raken replies.
Our eyes meet. Fear drives through my heart. Don't do anything, please.
He stares ahead at the city skyline as we descend into the main palace, toward the medical facility on one of the subterranean floors. Upon arrival, I find that the Adam physicians on duty have been expecting me. I'm ushered into a private room, where a male technician cuts my taped bandages away. He provides me with a white bodysuit, with cutouts that expose my ribs. After donning the flimsy garment, I'm joined by a team of physicians. I expect Raken to leave, but he doesn't. He presides over the medical team, scrutinizing every device. My ribs are scanned. Knowing what's ahead, I want to forgo it. But Raken convinces me to submit to the bone fusion and skin regeneration procedure. I lie down on the table beneath the white lights and looming laser arm. A second-born female technician enters and takes a seat behind the laser's control panel. The rest of the Adam-fated medical team leaves. Raken sits beside me. The laser emits a nauseating whine as it boots up.
I hate this part, I murmur.
Raken lifts his chin toward the technician.
Give her something for pain.
She's second-born, the woman replies. Pain relief isn't protocol in non-combat situations.
How much to circumvent protocol? He asks.
The technician looks around. 100 merits.
Done.
She slides from her seat and leaves the room.
You're going to make me soft, I murmur.
I'll risk it this one time.
In minutes, she's back with a cylindrical tank. I can't give her the regulated drugs. They track them. But this will do the trick. It'll make her happy and sleepy. It's a little old-fashioned, but effective. She threads tubes over my ears and into my nostrils, instructing me to breathe deeply. I do. A heady rush of euphoria softens my pain. I smile broadly and giggle. Raken matches my smile with his own.
What's so funny? He asks.
Nothing. My life is utter hell, I sigh, and then laugh harder.
The technician winks at him before reclaiming her seat at the controls. The laser moves, emitting a precise beam. I don't care. I feel like I'm floating.
I didn't know this could be painless, I say. No one ever told me when I had this done before.
Raken frowns.
Dune was probably trying to prepare you for the life of a transitioned soldier.
Nothing could prepare me for that. I laugh lightheartedly, even though I mean every word.
The laser moves around, fusing cracks in my bones. My skin and muscle will be repaired after the bone is set. The smell is atrocious, but even that doesn't matter.
Raken leans near my ear. Roselle,
What do you want?
Want? I smile dreamily. I don't know. What do you want?
He's silly. No one ever asks me that.
You can tell me. What's your greatest ambition?
His aquamarine eyes shine like light on water.
Middle age, I mutter with more giggles.
The room spins. I close my eyes.
What else?
Raken touches my arm. I open my eyes again.
A puppy, I whisper. I've always wanted a puppy. Isn't that a strange word? Puppy. Puppy.
Anything else? A faraway voice asks, distracting me.
Hawthorne, not to hate me.
My eyelids are too heavy to keep open.
Someone who will sticketh.
I feel him take my hand. Someone squeezes my shoulder. I open my eyes, squinting and tearing up in the white lights. Turning my head, I find Raken beside me.
How do you feel? He asks.
Thirsty, I reply, sitting up and rubbing my eyes. Raken hands me a small cup of water. I take it and drink it all in one long swallow. He takes the empty cup and thrusts an armload of clothes at me.
Get dressed. We don't have a lot of time.
For what? I look down at myself. All my bruising is gone. My skin is smooth.
I found your father's body. They're going to transport him to Sword soon. We have to hurry.
In stunned silence, I rise and change into slacks and a loose-fitting top. Raken turns his back and waits by the door.
I don't know whose clothes these are, but they're comfortable.
My ribs no longer ache. I can breathe deeply, without pain. Bending isn't a problem either. I slip on the shoes Raken left on the chair. He opens the door and waits for me to pass through.
This way.
He directs me to a stairwell at the back of the medical facility. Descending several flights, we stop at a red hatch-like door. Raken uses his moniker to infiltrate a program into the Halo Palace's operating system. In seconds, the hatch pops open. I pass through. The corridor is cold and empty, but when voices sound from the junction up ahead, Raken jerks my elbow and pulls me to a nearby doorway. We flatten against the wall. I glare at him.
Didn't you clear this?
Not exactly.
His jaw tightens. There wasn't time. They're shipping him to Swords in a couple of hours. It was now or never.
I don't know the state of his body, Roselle.
The corridor quiets. Raken grasps my hand. Our fingers thread. We hurry to the last door on the end. Checking his moniker, he says,
"This is it."
He unlatches the door and opens it. The morgue contains long steel tables with shiny surfaces. Long hoses hang from the ceiling, like tentacle arms of a monstrous sea creature. Fluid congeals inside a swollen sac suspended from above. The air reeks of it. And of death. I hold my fingers to my nose. Raken closes the door behind us. No one attends the bodies. Every table has a corpse on it. Most of them are Sword socialites still in their god or goddess costumes. A few are assassins. I pause by one of the death gods. He doesn't have a moniker. It was either cut out and repaired extremely well, or he never had one. I scan the room for my father. At the far end of the morgue, high above one of the tables, a levitating transporter pod waits to be lowered over a supine corpse. I move toward it, weaving through victims, trying not to look at them. I shudder when I see it's him, and a small gasp escapes me. His pieces must have been fused back together. Someone took their time with him, cleaning him up and dressing him in a plain white outfit. His eyelids are closed. He looks peaceful. Streaks of tears drip from my chin, spattering on the metal table. Reaching out, I touch his hair, smoothing it back. I don't ever remember touching it before. Did he ever hold me? Did my chubby baby hands ever touch his face? I can't change this,
I whisper. I can't fix anything.
No, you can't change this, Raiken replies. But you can change the world, Roselle. The future.
Why bother? No one's worth it.
You're worth it. Do it for you.
I wipe my chin and cheeks with the back of my sleeve, sniffling.
Do you want a moment alone? He asks gently.
I nod, and he walks away to give me some time. When he comes back, I know it's time to go. I dry the tears from my cheeks with the backs of my sleeves. I'm ready. Raiken slips the pinky ring from my father's hand. It has an embossed golden halo on it. The ring has been in his family for generations. Kennet loved to wear it because it's virtue faded, not sword faded.
Here, Raiken says, take this.
What are you doing? Put that back, I whisper shout. It's Gabriel's now.
Gabriel has everything. A palace full of your father's things. What do you have? Fused ribs?
I don't want it.
I move toward the door. Maybe not. But if you take it, that means your mother won't get it. You can bury it wherever he asked you to take him, as a symbolic gesture.
I pause. Is that what you did?
I buried all their favorite things together.
Turning toward Raiken, I hold out my hand. He drops the ring in my palm. Suddenly, a door swings open. Raiken and I both crouch to the floor like criminals. I peek from between the tables and see a pair of black boots. A voice says,
It wasn't easy extracting the horns from Kennet Abjorn's cranium. Whoever did it must have really wanted him to keep them.
The voice of Agent Crow barks with laughter.
If you asked most people, he replies, they would swear the horns of the sword's husband were real.
This elicits more cackles from them both.
I had the room secured for your visit, the technician says. No other personnel have attended the bodies but me. Show me all the corpses without monikers, Agent Crow orders.
They walk from assassin to assassin. As they move, Raiken and I crawl along the ground, trying to make it back to the door unseen. My heart thumps in my chest when Agent Crow pauses at a table a few feet from us. I hold my breath.
They don't appear to have had monikers. Wouldn't you agree? He asks. That is my conclusion as well,
the technician says proudly.
It's astounding.
Quite, Agent Crow agrees.
They wander toward my father, and Raiken and I scurry for the open door. In the empty corridor, I get to my feet and hug the wall. Raiken is beside me in seconds, breathing hard. We hurry up the hall, exiting the morgue the way we came in.
That census agent is everywhere, Raiken mutters.
You have no idea, I reply with a shudder.
After backtracking through the medical center, I breathe easier. We take another airlift. My father's ring is heavy in my fist.
You're on lockdown until further notice, Raiken orders softly. Don't even think about leaving the palace grounds.
I don't answer him. The elevator doors open.
They didn't have monikers, I mumble. What does that mean?
Raiken's expression is grim.
I don't know.
He follows me out of the lift. I know my way from here.
Get used to me, Roselle. I'm not going anywhere.
When we get to my apartment, I find a half dozen security stingers hovering around by it. I glare at Raiken, but he merely shrugs. Once inside, I close the door immediately. Phoenix's clanging steps ring out in the foyer. I smile, despite everything, and kneel to greet it.
Hey, I missed you, Fee. I have something important. Can you hold it for me?
The Mechadome's red lenses nod. I hold up my father's ring. Phoenix lifts its vacuum arm and sucks the ring out of my palm. It disappears inside the squat bot. Thank you. Raiken is already in the den after securing the apartment with his whisper orb. He sits on the sofa, leans his head back, and closes his eyes.
I cross my arms and rest against the doorframe. No one touches Hawthorne.
Raiken doesn't open his eyes.
Not your decision, he replies, his jaw tight.
It is if you ever want my help with anything in the future.
We have your friends.
My eyes narrow. We'd all risk our lives for Hawthorne, and he'd do the same for us, so he won't talk. Tell them what I just said. Make Dune and Daltrey understand that this point is non-negotiable. You kill him, I kill all of you.
Raiken opens his eyes and lifts his head.
They're going to want to use him. When Hawthorne was second-born, he hated the way things were. Now that he's first-born, I don't know what he'll do. He says he loves me, but he'll think that joining the Gates of Dawn is treason. This is going against everything we were raised to believe. Breaking that kind of indoctrination doesn't happen overnight, if ever. I'll see what I can do to explain things to him, but I can't promise anything. He has fought against the Gates of Dawn in active combat. It'll feel like he's betraying the soldiers he commanded.
Tell him his life depends on it.
No.
Tell him your life depends on it.
Does it? I ask.
All of ours do, Roselle.
My plan to sneak into Hawthorne's room shouldn't terrify me, but it does. Under the cover of darkness, I pad softly out onto my balcony. Scaling the ornate stonework of the building, I climb several stories to a ledge wide enough to walk on. My footsteps don't make much noise as I hurry across the outside of the Halo Palace. The balmy breeze carries the scent of roses from the garden below. I'm turning frosty from the phantom orb in my pocket, which masks my body temperature from the stingers. The swatch of lead covering my moniker does the rest. Having memorized the route, I'm almost 100% certain that the balcony below me is Hawthorne's newly issued suite, granted to him while he answers questions about the attack against the social club. He has a sea view, like me, but on the other side of Grisham's residence. I scale down and pry open the glass panel doors. No lights are on, but my night vision glasses compensate. For a moment, I worry that I have the wrong apartment, but then I recognize the true grave crest on the fusion blade locked in the weapons vault in the wall. My heart races. He should have his sword with him. I could be an assassin. I tread softly up the stairs. At the top of the landing, something doesn't feel right. I pause and listen. The soft sounds of sleep breathing rasps from the other side of the bedroom door. Gently, I ease it open. It's dark. Hawthorne is burrowed under his blanket. Moving forward, I just about make it to his bed when a lamp turns on. My hands go up to shield my eyes as the night vision glasses adjust. I lower my arms. My heart beats like that of a leverets before a coyote. Hawthorne is seated in the chair in the corner with a fusion mag in his hand. He's dressed all in black, like me. Devastation ravages his face. He raises a remote and cuts the fake sleep sounds coming from the area near the bed.
I prayed it wouldn't be you, Hawthorne says sorrowfully. I figured Winterstrom would try to do it himself.
What are you talking about? I whisper. I take a step in his direction. He holds the fusion mag a little higher.
How were you going to do it?
Hawthorne asks, choking on emotion. Do what?
Kill me.
I could never, I say in a rush. How could you think that? I'm here to talk. I swear, I'm unarmed. I hold up my hands and turn around slowly.
What's in your pocket? He asks suspiciously.
I reach in slowly and pull out two orbs. This is a phantom orb. It masks me from the stingers. I hold up the other. This is a whisper orb. It forms a perimeter around us so we can't be overheard. I trigger the whisper orb, and an iridescent bubble billows outward.
Set them on the floor.
He motions with the fusion mag. I do, slowly.
You came here to talk, he snarls. So, talk.
The pained look of having been betrayed etches every line of his face. It breaks me. I feel a tear slip from my eye and wipe it away. Hawthorne, I struggle for the right words.
Are you?
Are you a fate traitor? Sadness frays his voice. I move a step closer. He holds the fusion mag a little higher. I stop. It's not what it seems, Hawthorne.
What is it, then? He asks bitterly.
Have you ever let yourself think that maybe every Fates Republic secondborn is on the wrong side?
Never.
Rage transforms his face. Were you in the same war as me? Didn't you see them sending us back in body bags?
Yes, I saw. I also saw the Gates of Dawn body bags, and the way we slaughtered their wounded without mercy.
And for what? So the Fates Republic can tear us away from our families, enslave us, and send us off to die while they attend balls and soirees and watch us kill each other in sadistic games they create in the name of entertainment? I'm tired of being on the wrong side, Hawthorne. I just can't justify what they're doing anymore.
I don't even know you, do I? He seethes.
You know me, I reply, with a note of desperation. And you know your friends, the ones who love you unconditionally. They're fate traitors, too.
Because of you, he accuses.
I did what I had to do to save their lives. I'm not going to apologize for it.
How long? He demands.
How long what?
How long have you been the enemy?
I'm not your enemy, I insist. I made a deal for Edgerton's and Hammond's lives. You were gone. No one else could help them. But there was no going back after that. I just didn't know it until now.
How does Winterstrom play into all of this?
I can't tell you.
You can't or you won't?
I won't.
He's firstborn, Hawthorne says. How do you know that you can trust him?
He has plenty of reasons to hate the Fates Republic.
It's not too late, Roselle. Whatever you're mixed up in, we can get you out. Salloway will help, I'm sure of it.
Don't involve him, please, Hawthorne. He's more dangerous than you know.
He wants you to rule Swords. Once you do, you can make the kind of changes that matter.
You want me to be the Sword?
I want you to live, he retorts. The Rose Gardeners will make you the clarity of our fate. You'll be powerful.
You want us to live as firstborns, while our friends are hunted by census?
Let's say I agree to all of that.
One day, we'll have to give our secondborn child to a system that will brutalize her until the day she dies. Now who's the traitor? We'd be betraying our child like our parents betrayed us. We've been brainwashed for so long that it's hard to see the truth, Hawthorne. But once you do, you can't unsee it. Anything less than freedom for all secondborns is unacceptable. Anything less than life for thirdborns is murder. When you accept that, you won't be able to go blindly along with the Fates Republic anymore. You'd rather die for freedom than live one more day without it.
You will die if you keep this up, Roselle.
It's only treason if I lose. I take a step in his direction, and when he doesn't shoot, I take another, and another, until I'm close enough to reach for the fusion mag. I'm still the woman you shared a million kisses with. I touch the cool metal of the barrel. It's still me. Hawthorne groans, relinquishing his weapon.
If you're going to kill me, do it fast.
In seconds, I disassemble the fusion mag and set the pieces on the side table. I stare down into his eyes. His hand lifts to the back of my neck. He pulls me nearer until my lips meet his in a ferocious, all-consuming kiss.
Why are you doing this? He asks.
Because it's right. Like you and I are right. We can save them, Hawthorne. This isn't unfaithfulness to Sword Secondborns. It's loyalty. We can change their lives for the better. Don't decide now. Just think about it. I'm only asking you to continue to protect Hammond, Edgerton, and me with your silence. Hawthorne pulls me down to him. I straddle his hips. His hand cups my jaw. His thumb traces my cheek. His sorrow burns away in the heat of his desire. The yearning that always accompanies his touch destroys my resolve.
As his thumb slides over my bottom lip, I shiver, craving more. I wish he could hold me until I die. My hands slip under his shirt, feeling his muscles beneath my fingertips. I push away the black fabric. He grasps the hem, lifting it off over his head and dropping it on the floor. The sight of him makes me long to be his again. I wish he were still secondborn. I know I shouldn't, but I do. He was mine then. I want him back. His hands thread through my hair, pulling it from its knot. The strands unfurl around my shoulders and down my back. His expression turns fiercer, and he tugs off my eyewear. With his hands under my thighs, he picks me up. I wrap legs around his waist and my wrists around his neck, drawing his mouth to mine. We kiss as he carries me to his bed and sets me down. My back touches the blankets. His knee digs into the mattress beside my hip. Long fingers splay in my hair. Firm lips hover above me. Inching up my black shirt, Hawthorne pulls it over my head and tosses it haphazardly on the floor. "How are your ribs?" he asks. His eyes move with his fingers, stroking a path down my skin, gently touching the ones that were broken. It's both sensual and ticklish. Gasping softly, I suck in my bottom lip to keep from giggling. A rush of desire overtakes me. "Did I hurt you?" "No." I breathe the word, but I don't know if it's true. I ache for him to keep touching me, to never stop. "I'm okay now. I had them repaired." His lips travel with whisper softness over my ribs, his warm breath against my cool skin. I inhale sharply. His finger hooks in the fabric of my black bra, the valley between the cups where the clasp lies. "If I'm not mistaken, this isn't military issue," he murmurs. His fingertips rim the edges of the fabric. Heat pours through me. My skin flushes. "They gave me girl clothes." "Oh, I noticed." His finger deftly unclasps my bra. His shadow of a beard skims against my breast. His mouth latches onto my hardened nipple. I arch up against his lips, my eyes closing, my mouth opening. His tongue flicks, and my ache intensifies to a burning need. I grip his arm, digging into his muscle. "Hawthorne," I whisper harshly. "I missed your voice," he growls low against me, kissing the valley between my breasts. "The raspy way you say my name when you want me, it rushes under my skin." "I always want you." "You're all that matters to me," Hawthorne confesses. "That, too, is an act of treason." He rests his forehead against my belly and sighs. "This isn't how I saw this night ending." "Hawthorne, this is how I want every night with you to end." He closes his eyes. "I love you, Roselle." "Maybe it's okay. Maybe just this one time." Hawthorne opens his eyes and shakes his head. "We can't, Roselle. They'd murder you. I won't risk it. We shouldn't even be doing this, especially here. Just kissing could get you flayed. I'm so weak around you." He gets off the bed, finds my shirt, and hands it to me. I reclasp my bra and slip my shirt on. He sits beside me and then lies back against the mattress, staring up at the ceiling. I rest my cheek on his chest, listening to his heartbeat slow. He wraps his arms around me. I know I need to go. Dawn is coming. I try to sit up, but his arms tighten. "Hawthorne," I whisper. He kisses my hair. "I know," he replies, but his arms don't loosen. "How long are you staying at the Halo Palace?" "I have to leave first thing in the morning." "Why?" I apply a bit more pressure, and he relents, easing his grip on me. I rise on my elbow so I can see his face. He reaches for my hair, tucking strands of it back behind my ear. "They already know what happened at the social club," he says. "It was captured by the surveillance drones. They just wanted to know why I was there."
"Do they know about us?"
"Not in the winter corridor, just in the gallery and ballroom. Salloway told them that the snowy hallway isn't monitored because it's private, and the members like it that way. But you only had to watch us together in the gallery to see my devotion to you.
My voice softens. You jumped after me, even when you thought I might already be dead.
Yeah. It's pretty clear I'm in love with you.
And I love you, Hawthorne, but...
I think for a moment.
How did you explain being there?
I told them I came there to see you because we were second-born friends.
How did the virtue take that?
Hawthorne exhales deeply. He didn't like it. Said I was first-born now and I ought to know better than to try to maintain friendships with second-borns. Then he gave me another honorary title and a small piece of land in the Fate of Seas for my bravery at the social club, and told me I'm not allowed to see you anymore. Then he wished me well with my engagement.
Hawthorne's jaw ticks with tension. My throat tightens. Now there's no hope in appealing to the virtue to break the marriage contract between Hawthorne and Fauna. Will I see you again?
Seeing you again is the only thing that will occupy my mind, he says, until I find a way.
I hope it's soon. I have to go, I whisper. Goodbye, Hawthorne. My own devastation is almost more than I can bear. I kiss his cheek, get to my feet, and retrieve the orbs and night vision glasses. Shoving the orbs in my pocket, I put on the glasses and move toward the door. I tug on the handle, but Hawthorne's hand reaches past my shoulder and holds the door closed.
I'll never talk, he whispers. Your secret is safe, but you knew that already. I have to think about everything else.
A shiver slides through me. I lean back against him, feeling the strength in his powerful body. I turn around and meet his eyes. He leans down and kisses me with a yearning that threatens to destroy us both. When he lifts his lips from mine, I murmur, "Thank you, Hawthorne," and then slip out the way I came.
Chapter 12. Lullaby of Insomnia. I'm confined to the Halo Palace. It's even worse than prior to the attack. Now I'm followed everywhere by hovering virtue stingers for my protection, just like Grisham. And, like Grisham, I'm restricted to the Firstborn Commander's private residence. Security has been reinforced with increased exo-presence and heightened technology provided by Salloway Munitions. Huge mechanized weapons were airlifted and placed on the cliff outside my balcony, just beyond the garden. The guns can track and shoot just about anything out of the sky without much trouble. They can do the same to people. Raiken hasn't visited me in a couple of days, even though he can. I told him that Hawthorne agreed to stay silent and to think about helping us. I thought Raiken would be happy to hear that, but he didn't take the news well. Instead, he stomped around my apartment, giving me the silent treatment while working on Phoenix's hover mode. I was too tired to argue with the firstborn star, but Phoenix doesn't clang anymore. It silently glides everywhere it goes. Raiken left shortly after dawn the morning I'd returned from speaking to Hawthorne in his room. He'd mumbled an excuse about discussing everything that's happened with Dune and Daltrey. I haven't seen him since. Not that he hasn't seen me. Through Phoenix, he can surveil me any time he wants. Although I think I can tell now when Phoenix is in auto mode and when the Mechadome is Raiken-possessed. It's a subtle changeover. Phoenix doesn't watch me in the literal sense. It sort of just keeps track of me. But Raiken-possessed Phoenix is a stalker. Like now. It's just parked in front of me, staring, as I lie on the sofa in the den. I'd throw a blanket over its head, but it will just pull it off, so it doesn't seem worth the effort. With my cheek against the seat cushion, I stare blankly at the vapid holographic announcer, describing how to get the most from my next virtual vacation. Yawning, I couldn't care less. I'm so tired, but I can't sleep. Not much, anyway. Only a few hours, and then I'm awake, panicking about whether Hawthorne will change his mind and decide he never wants to see me again. Or maybe the Gates of Dawn will conclude that it's safer to kill Hawthorne. Or 100 other equally terrifying scenarios. It's exhausting. So I just watch virtual access, hoping for something so boring it forces me to sleep. I search through what's on.
The face and profile of an atom-faded man flashes inside my den, while anchors from a news organization flitter about in excitement. Along with the man's image are a description and a short bio of his physical traits. "Before we go to our live coverage in Swords," the commentator says, "we have a second-born deserter bulletin in effect for the purity area of virtues." I sit up, recognizing the morgue director Rakin and I encountered a few days ago. His sandy, wiry hair and goonish leer are unmistakable. "Cranston Adam, Master Mortician, has failed to report for duty in over 24 hours. If you know the whereabouts of Cranston Adam, you are asked to contact your local census agency." Before I have time to process the implications of the missing secondborn, his image is gone, replaced by the soaring city skyline of Forge, where citizens are lining the streets, waving blue flags adorned with a golden sword in the center of each. The female newscaster smiles somberly. "We're just about ready to witness the procession coming down the Avenue of Swords," she says in a hushed tone, "on their way to the memorial where they will lay to rest a cultural icon, the faded sword. It's a sad day for the clarity of swords, the firstborn sword, and all their fate. As you can see, mourners line the streets, hoping to get one last glimpse of the faded sword before his internment in Killian Abbey." The anchor is firstborn. It's customary for only firstborns to cover such prestigious events. She peers directly into the drone camera's lens. "The faded sword is, of course, the father of firstborn Gabriel St. Sismode and his arguably more famous younger sister, secondborn Roselle Sword." Whispers of her dark hair blow in the cold air. The tip of her nose is red. White plumes of breath show as she continues. "I'm standing in front of one of the largest tributes to a secondborn ever erected." She gestures with her hand. The drone camera pans to a skyscraper behind her. On the side of it, a holographic image plays the footage of me tackling the Death God and shattering through the glass wall of the Sword Social Club. My stomach twists in a knot. I know what that is. It's propaganda, designed to undermine Gabriel and his inherent position. Most people won't understand that they're being influenced, but my mother will. The drones turn back to the newscaster and the Avenue of Swords. Slowly, I lie back down. My cheek rests against the cushion. I stare at the funeral procession playing out in front of me. I want to feel nothing, but a wave of crushing sorrow hits me. Tears leak out of the corners of my eyes, but I don't bother to wipe them away. I just sob. The channel changes on its own. It stops on a cuisine program. Rows and rows of Krellas line the case at a bakery in the Fate of Sons. With the handheld remote, I turn the hologram back to the funeral. The three-dimensional image of my mother and brother leaving the Sword Palace scurries across the den. I can hardly make out their shapes behind their Vicolt's tinted windows. The image changes again to some sort of dance recital. I glare at my mechadome. "Rakin, stop!" Rakin-possessed Phoenix shakes its lenses. "No." "Yes!" I yell. I can't remember ever being this angry in my life. I try to turn it back, but the entire virtual access unit completely dies. Frantically, I point the remote at the receiver. Nothing happens. I turn and glare at Rakin-possessed Phoenix. "I hate you!" Getting up from the couch, I storm out of the room and then out of the apartment. Stingers flank me as I run down the corridor to the nearest exit. The bright sunlight is a shock after hours of being inside with the privacy shutters drawn. Wiping at my cheeks, I try to hide my hot tears from the sun-faded secondborns I pass in the garden. Before I know it, I'm down the stone steps and onto the beach. I jog along the shoreline, trying to outrun my demons. When I get to the bend, I find Belmora, once again staring off at her sea castle. She's in front of a hovering easel, painting the structure as if her life depends on it. Beside her, the little 12-year-old girl watches her. Belmora lowers her brush and looks at me. Her smile is big and toothy, until she reads the look on my face. She sees my limp hair and lounging attire. Roselle, she says, what's wrong? What's happened?
She reaches out and touches my arm.
Do you have virtual access in your residence?
Yes.
Can I see it?
Of course.
She sets aside her paintbrush and locks her arm in mine.
The nearest death drone begins to wail and hover nearer.
Oh, hush, she exclaims, waving it away.
It silences and settles back to hover at a distance. She walks with me across the sandbar toward the gigantic doors of her sea fortress. Her attendants scramble to gather up her belongings behind us.
Are you okay? She asks.
No, I reply honestly, trying to hold back tears. They're memorializing my father today, and my visual access is broken.
Oh, she replies in a sympathetic tone. I hadn't known that you two were close.
We weren't. My toes sink into the damp sand, leaving a trail of footprints.
And yet, you're upset, she says, puzzled.
I'd hoped that someday things would be different between us.
Oh, she says softly. And it wasn't because he was a narcissist?
Did you know Kennett?
No. My father always said yours was a narcissist. I sort of envied you for that.
What? I sniffle. Why?
Well, mine's a tyrant, so yours didn't sound so bad, she replies with a wink.
Despite everything, I feel myself smile.
As we walk, Valmora chats about the architectural features of her castle, pointing out each of the 9 spires that represent the 9 fates. Seagulls perch and gossip overhead. We pass through the enormous portico, and the shade of it feels several degrees cooler, the damp air heavier. An inner courtyard lies within the high stone walls. The sun finds us once more as we walk across the lawn. The ever-present sound of the waves follows us until we climb the steps and enter the royal stone edifice. Dimness greets us. It takes a second for my eyes to adjust. The ceiling is high in the foyer. Exposed wooden beams are draped with colorful banners from all the fates. Sunlight dots the floor from high windows. Ancient painted portraits of past secondborn commanders are everywhere. It's like going back in time.
You have a beautiful home, I murmur.
She looks around with a critical eye. There are some days that I think I'll go mad if I have to stay here one more second. Her honesty is surprising. I sometimes wonder if I'd have been better off born into a lowly Fate of Seas family in a fishing village somewhere. At least then I'd be allowed to sail away, go places, see things firsthand. She gazes at me. But we can't change our fate. Can we?
The way she says it, it sounds more like a challenge than a certainty.
Come, my media room is this way.
We pass through a glass sunroom and into a round room with a grand balcony that overlooks the sea. Valmora stops.
Quincy, she says to the girl, who is still following us, make sure no one comes in. I want privacy.
The freckled girl nods solemnly and stands guard outside. Valmora closes the doors. She goes to the airy balcony, drawing the curtains, shutting off the stone terrace. The beautiful white fabric waves in the breeze. Using her silver halo-shaped moniker, she dims the lights and turns on her virtual access to holographic mode. Rapidly changing the station, Valmora pauses on one showing nothing but holographic smoke-filled gloom. Dust obscures the visual, but the audio is something else entirely. Screams of chaos swirl from the audio feed. Valmora turns to me, shocked.
What's happening?
I shake my head in confusion. I don't know. Try another channel. Valmora changes it. It's the same, except firstborns with red-rimmed eyes and golden sword monikers are emerging from the smoke with their hands over their noses and mouths.
Is that swords? Valmora asks, with a catch in her voice.
Try another station, I demand.
The next one is similar, but an announcer is saying, an explosion, or what we believe was an explosion, has occurred in the city of Forge, where the fated sword was being memorialized today on his way to Killian Abbey.
Swords has been attacked, I say to Valmora, though I hardly recognize the voice as mine.
It's unclear how many casualties there are, the announcer continues, and whether the sword or firstborn Gabriel Saint Sismode were harmed in the incident that some are now calling an attack. Balmora reaches out